Welcome to the Millennium Live Podcast. We're back with another episode partnered with Splunk to deliver engaging cybersecurity content. Jumping on the podcast is Craig Hyde, Field CTO at Splunk. He's joined by Todd Beebe, Chief Information Security Officer at Freeport LNG. The conversation centers around aligning security operations, balancing compliance and proactive security, the evolving threat landscape, and scaling to meet the demands of a modern cybersecurity operation.
Thanks, Connor. And thanks for having us on this podcast today. Really excited to talk with Todd. Todd is a CISO at Freeport LNG. He's got a very interesting non-standard background, also a firefighter. Todd, just give a quick intro on yourself and we can get started.
Okay, yeah. So very early on in my career, I was immediately put into kind of the security role, even though there wasn't security at the time. It was like, hey, we're connecting to the internet, we need firewalls, go figure it out. And I just kind of stayed with it as just the, you know, one of the team members. I've heard this a lot with other people in security of, they just raised their hand, right? And next thing you know, that was their responsibility to go learn it and try to get it deployed. Over time, I became very skilled in being able to validate or test security, and was brought in to build a practice for a major, at that time, Big Six for attack and pen. So that really kind of colored and kind of focused my attention on that kind of mindset, even though most of my roles after that were really on the defensive side. That always was forefront of my mind, even when I would be sitting in meetings and people would be talking about something like, oh, what did you just say? And then it was like I could almost see the path of what an attacker would take with if they deployed it that way. So that's probably where I think I differ a little bit from most information security officers or CISOs, is that extremely technical, and I never stopped doing that. So to this day, I'm still testing the systems. I'm still validating patches work if there's vulnerabilities in the organization. So that's never left my blood. I've never grown up or grown out of it. So that influences a lot of my decisions and my priorities.
Yeah, with the technical and kind of the attack side, like how does that manifest itself in terms of differences with other CISOs or other security professionals that either you've worked with or worked alongside of, in terms of like, you know, do you bring different viewpoints? If so, how do you prioritize different things? If so, what? Those kinds of things from a day-to-day perspective.
Yes. So I prioritize what we get from threat intel to being kind of the Bible versus a compliance and governance mindset of, hey, if we meet this or if we get a maturity rating of a 5, then we're good. Those are, and there's a lot of standards out there where they talk about hardening a device, and there's, you know, 1,000 different settings that are in there from, you know, when XP or, you know, Windows 3.1 were around, but those never left the standard. And nobody looks at it and says, what are the ones that will really prevent a breach of this system? And so I think with my mindset, I look at it and I prioritize different. It isn't that I think we shouldn't have standards and we shouldn't secure all the systems in the environment, but the difference I've seen in compliance and my mindset is prioritization. You know, and compliance is usually has just a, your organization is at this level, the most critical devices you have are missing the most critical patches. Mm-hmm. It isn't designed to prioritize because it's trying to be something that everybody can get some value out of, but it doesn't help prevent a breach in that organization specifically based upon what are my threats. So I'm very threat oriented and paying attention to what threat actors are doing, and then actively determining if that activity would go undetected in our environment and fixing that. It's very much a constant validation. It's kind of, you know, the infamous cat and mouse game of what's the mice are doing. Well, then in order for me to catch it, this is what I got to do differently, right? It's a lot more mentally intensive because I'm not just going off of a script of what the government says. I mean, I've helped build cybersecurity frameworks, but that's what they are. They're kind of frameworks to help people get to a mature level. But then when you're at that level, it's like, what are you going to do to prevent the threat actors that are really targeting you?
Mm-hmm. So, that's interesting, because it sounds like the way that you're thinking about it, it doesn't necessarily say this framework does not apply, right? It's not saying that the compliance frameworks that exist, call it NIST or whatever the SEC comes out with, It's not saying that it's not valid, but almost that your approach to what is the most important is driven solely based upon what are the real risks that we have in the environment versus what does this 175-page document tell us we have to do? Is that fair? Yeah. Do you feel like sometimes people get lost in the weeds working through the compliance and don't see the forest through the trees?
I think part of it is if they didn't have that technical background, because a lot of the individuals I see at the meetings are, they came up through the business. So they understand. I mean, I literally was at a conference where I was a speaker and I was speechless when they were talking, because they were all talking, you know, risk and all these equations and stuff like this. And I literally looked at the next person next to me like, I got nothing. And then when I got a chance to talk, I talked about these are the security controls I would use in an ICS environment. And then people kind of realized, okay, that's where I fit. You know what I mean? I was brought in for a specific role. And to me, it's kind of the difference between a building inspector going in and making sure that it meets all the guidelines. Mm-hmm. And then the building ages a little bit. If you bring in, and they actually are looking at various security controls, we need these, you know, windows like this. You bring in a former burglar, and they'll notice things that maybe the building inspector didn't like. Hey, do you guys realize you have absolutely no sensors on your second floor? And, you know, but that wasn't in the building code. So they were trying to meet the building code, which they did, but they didn't see it through the eyes of a threat who's saying, I'm just trying to find the path in, right? And the path to whatever I need to get to. And is that path still, is that, can I find a way to get to that without getting caught, right? So it's just that little mindset, I think, is the big difference that I've seen is, I just constantly think, one of my team members, she says, you've got a hacker brain. So, I mean, that's what she calls me, is, oh, your hacker brain just kicked in. So it's definitely, it's helped. It's hard to find that in other CISOs that I've interacted with.
So. Yeah. That's interesting, because a lot of, you know, you go to a Millennium conference, and a lot of the thread comes to aligning with the business goals, right? And sometimes they are just, we have to go get compliant, because that is another threat in itself, right? Is if you're not compliant, that opens you up to lawsuits, it opens you up to, you know, different organizational issues. But your focus, it seems like the key focus is like, what is cybersecurity's number one job? It's not get hacked.
Correct. Right. I mean, how I look at it is there's a difference between a risk. To me, risks are hypothetical, like a hurricane will hit your organization or a flood will hit you. It's, you know, probability, right? Mm-hmm. And I've actually seen organizations where they tried to, you know, implement that probability to cyber. And then when I look at cyber, here's the analogy or the story I like to tell people, not story, but little snippet is, it's one thing to think, okay, I've met the requirements. I got alarm systems on all my windows, all my doors and everything else. I feel like I'm good, right? Because I know there might be a robbery, but I think I got enough controls. It's a whole different story when that risk turns to an active threat. Because tornadoes and hurricanes, they don't change their path just to go after something that's more vulnerable. But if a police officer came to your door, knocked on it, said, hey, guess what? We just found your name on a list that the burglary organization in this neighborhood is coming after your home.
Yeah.
You're going to look a lot differently at, do I really have enough security controls? And that's what's changed, is the visibility in the threats that are out there that are actively trying to get into something versus it's just a matter of chance, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the big difference to me, is the probabilities of the hurricane hitting this every 5 years is this in this area of getting, you know, have fire and damage that goes beyond a single room is this. Okay, we got that covered. But if something's actively trying to do it, it will modify its behavior to continue it. You know, it's like the tornado says, I'm taking your, it doesn't have a mind that says, I'm going to take your house out. If you got lucky, you got lucky. But I think that's the difference, is they're applying that probability of compliance of light, you know, of these unlikely events, potentially occurring to, well, if you look at your email gateways, how many times have you blocked malicious emails trying to get in? Did they stop because you stopped them? No, they continue day, right?
It's an absolute.
Yes. I mean, they're until their boss tells them to move on to an easier target, they're going to keep attempting because that's human nature. You know, is that I'm going to finish my job, right? So I think they're, once they start thinking in that threat mindset that there's an active actor that's going to change their behavior, then it becomes a different risk. It's a threat. It's mm-hmm. what we do, because this is a long-term game that they're going to continue to try to find our weakness, right?
Yeah. In your organization, I'm just curious, what type of, like, what are those big risks that are always coming in the door?
And I don't want to talk about a specific organization, but I don't know if I counted as lucky, but I've been in multiple organizations where it was nation state level threat actors that mm-hmm. I was interacting with three letter agencies who were giving us play by play of how they were monitoring, actually seeing the behavior on the dark web of these threat actors. So you know, once you hear that, you can't unhear it. Like that takes it to a different level of, yeah, the tornado, it's got your address and it's mm-hmm. to do, right? It's like, mm-hmm. okay, do I really need shutters or do I need storm windows, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, mm-hmm. The budget changes. And the other thing I like to talk about is I've been lucky enough that in my life, most of the organizations don't look at me and say, okay, you know, justify this as a return on investment. It's mm-hmm. it's more like, okay, we're going to drive fast, so we're going to have airbags, we're going to have seatbelts because there's the likelihood of this happening. So what do you need to allow us to drive 100 miles an hour safely? And so thinking of it more as a cyber safety thing, it's like, if you want to have this business in the middle of the, you know, the craziest part of Brazil, you need to have these guards, you need to have these gates, you need to have these kind of, you know, devices out front that will stop a ramming car. It's like, you guys can do business there. It's still the same thing. It's business and enablement, but it's looking at it from, this is what you need to have in place so you guys don't have a lot of losses in that mm-hmm. organization. Because really what we're trying to do, cyber, is loss minimization. Just like firefighters, just like we're trying to keep it to a single room, right? To make the house still salvageable versus it's a total loss. And nobody expects fire departments, police departments, doctors to have 100% success rate. Like, nope, there can be no robberies in your neighborhood. Otherwise, we're going to fire the police chief. That's what I think. That's a separate conversation about the SEC, where they're like having this expectation of 100% prevention. But it's not so much prevent an incident. It's prevent it from being catastrophic. Just like seatbelts and airbags, they're not going to prevent all injury, but make it so the person can survive the incident, right? And just make sure the business can survive is kind of the mindset I come from.
What do you think the key components are that are constantly or the most overlooked?
The key components is assuming the controls you put in place mm-hmm. will continue to work as advertised. Because mm-hmm. we've seen it with products, upgrade in a product that was a security control, no longer blocks a certain thing that we thought it was blocking, mm-hmm. that it blocked when we tested it, you know, before deployment. And then, you know, something in the code base got reintroduced and now it no longer blocks that threat that we thought we had covered. So it triggers in me and in the team that I have this need to routinely revalidate that the security controls we have in place, both detective and preventive, are working. And I think that's what's missing is this assumption of we're good. You know, we got airbags and everything, the anti-lock brakes. It's like, I used to do this even when I was young in Nebraska with snow. When I'd be driving out, I'd hit the brakes hard to see how slippery the road was, because I wanted to gauge what's the risk level, right? The real risk currently right now. And it's kind of that same thing is, okay, let's essentially pen test your organization on a regular basis and throw at it the same things that a threat actor would and see, do we block and detect what we thought we were? Because then we can build from that. But if we find out, hold on, the gaps we thought we had covered are now uncovered again. If we continue just assuming we checked the box six years ago and we got that security control and we never tested again, we'll have a false sense of security.
So. With that, like ongoing testing, and you're all essentially, there's an element of shifting left, but it's also organizationally? Like there's an element of, you know, test early, test often,
right?
And make it an ongoing process so that you can, like, it's not, security is not just paint. You can't paint it on the door at the end. You have to bake it into the process. But there's also the organization, I'm hearing the organizational testing of, okay, we have a threat. What happens with incident response? How do they react? Go through those use cases. When you're going through this process, what's the breakdown of a manual versus automation that you have in either the testing, the active testing, or the responding from an incident response team?
The goal for the validation, we've tried to look for third-party solutions to do it, is to get it to the place where we can automate it and then get a report on a regular basis of, okay, what detections that were working when we set it up are no longer detecting right now. And once we see, you know, a deviation that goes beyond just a couple, then we kick into gear and jump back into the system and figure out, okay, what happened, right? Because we've seen it where we had EDR solutions where, you know, we say we test 1,000 things a day, right? We run 1,000 different simulations. It was doing fine. All of a sudden, now it's only detecting 600. We're like, what just happened, right? Mm-hmm. But if we wouldn't have had that ongoing validation, because it still detected a lot, that you know a good portion, of the majority, the team would still be getting alerts. But would they know they're getting alerts for everything that we thought we were alerting on, right?
Yep.
So it's that kind of it, you know, being able to detect that, we'll call it partial break, where something, you know, this leak, that when you look at it, the sprinkler systems are all going, but there's one area that's not getting anything, but it looks like everything's good to go. It's that false sense of security, and that's triggered us to be very vigilant about validate. Because we've had pen tests where they've come in and it was almost guaranteed that one of the security controls we had in place wouldn't detect some of their activity or wouldn't block some of their activity because of some one-off, you know, that always kind of just re-energize the team of, this is why we do what we do. You know, it's grindy to continually test something and not get that, hey, let's move on to something new. But firefighters, we do it too. You know, we have to trust that gear before we get to the fire and realize the hose was defective.
Yeah. And then what's the dynamic look like when, so you're going in, doing the pen test, find vulnerabilities. If you find new vulnerabilities, getting new threats that are coming in, how do you orchestrate that into the overall security operation to make sure that we're looking for the latest threats and make sure they have a complete view of all the things that are going on in the organization so we can, you know, do the firefighting when fires occur?
So we're connected with a good number of people in three-letter agencies, as well as some of the more active threat, both mm-hmm. researchers and incident responders like Twitter, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And we just leverage kind of the noise in the overall security community about certain things to know. Okay. I mean, usually it's real easy with vulnerabilities. If it gets a name like Blue Keep or anything like that, that's usually a bad one. You should, you know, any organization should be like, if it's got a name, set up a website for it. That's probably not a good thing. That probably means all they have to do is exploit that thing. They don't even need credentials. They'll just be on your system. So, again, I think it's just being in security for so long. I know enough people and I get a sense of where to look to find that latest intel on either, you know, some zero day or some setting or something like that that's being taken advantage of. And then that becomes a pretty quick priority. The great thing is the organization that I've, multiple organizations that I've been working with, I guess they brought me on because they were core believers in cyber. I wasn't giving them this laundry list of here's 1,000 vulnerabilities, go fix them on a, you know, 10,000 machines. It's like these two vulnerabilities on these machines that we really care about, then fix the rest. But really, I help kind of, look at it through their point of view is, if you're going to make us not prioritize anything and everything's a high priority, how will we know we got it covered if something's trying to target us right now? So I think it's that being that because of the experience, being very selective on what I ask them to deploy, whether it be a setting or a patch, they've realized, okay, I'm looking at it through their eyes too. I'm not just, hey, this is compliance says we have all patches done in the first 30 days. It's like, no, it's this one. You know what I mean? So by being able to be very surgical, I think has helped build the relationships between the teams, and then helps that that urgency kick in because they don't, okay, the only reason they're bringing it up is because this is a big deal, right?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So when the high priority vulnerabilities come out, you have to basically prioritize those to get out immediately.
Yes,
and deploy. And what about like active hacks, social engineering, insider threat type things? Are you like, how do you monitor that? How do you monitor for, you know, the threat actors coming in being an active threat where somebody's coming in and currently hacking, like from a SIM perspective or security operations, and how do you handle that?
Well, I guess I can say, cause I'm on your guys' podcast, we use Splunk, right? It's like, and again, I'm not just selling Splunk, but I was in cybersecurity before there was any kind of, and it was the same slogan is probably used today is, if there's no logs, there was no crime. You know what I mean? And the biggest pain in the early days of doing forensics is you literally had to log into each system and, you know, and still try to do it forensically. So it was slow. And then there usually, you know, was the setting in most of the devices was like 512 kilobytes or something like that, like less than a meg or something. And so they had already rolled. So logging is core, because you're, again, just like a fire, nobody's going to call you before a fire hits, so you can get there and prevent damage. That just doesn't occur. That's make believe. Same thing with, I mean, it's incident response for a reason. You know, I've said this before to other people. It's not incident prevention. It's incident response. There's something that started. There's smoke somewhere, and we want to get there before it becomes big. But without logs, then there can be no alerts. Right. It's and I got this saying from a guy that he was eventually a CEO of one of my companies. He had sold a company to Cisco. It was the first IDS. He had come out of the Air Force. And his saying, this is very early in my career, it was visibility and control. Right. And if you don't have visibility, you certainly don't have control. And so, so, you know, day one, when I come into an organization is like, do they have a SIM? And then do they have an EDR? You know, kind of, I need visibility, because then I can get the lay of the land of what's really going on and get a sense of where are my gaps and where are my priorities. But logging is core, right?
Yeah.
You have to have that before you even put in security controls, so you know what's normal.
Right? It's interesting. I mean, it's almost like you can't, the old saying of you can't manage what you can't measure.
Exactly. So
I've never heard it like, you know, you've got to get the logging in before you put the controls in. But it, I mean, it's true. If regardless of the controls, if you can't see anything, what's the point?
Well, because then how do you know you're not blocking something legitimate, right? Mm-hmm. You don't know what normal is. So how will you know what's abnormal unless it's triggering some security control like AV or a firewall or something where it has specific rules? But then, if you don't have that going somewhere, then you got to make sure that's all going to your email. So it's like you got to have some place to get the visibility, because then you can make the business cases too of, hey, we really want to isolate these 27 very critical systems. Well, you know, they're very important to us. Well, we've looked at the logs for the last 90 days, and it's only these three workstations that ever talked to them. So we're not going to, we now have evidence, not for of a crime, but evidence to show you why we can put in a security control and not impact business. So eventually it does come back where I do interact with the business, even though I'm technical, right? But I usually like to bring them the story.
You wouldn't be in your chair. You wouldn't be in your seat if you didn't know how to communicate and interact with the business and get what you wanted.
Well, it's because I do communicate, but I communicate with reality, not the fear stuff. It's like, I'll literally come into a company when I start in a couple of weeks, first couple of weeks, and I'll show them why we need a certain patch. I'll exploit the system and say, look how quickly now I'm system on the system. You know what I mean? I can do anything. And they're like, okay, I see the value.
Yeah, fix that.
Right. It's just that. It's like I'm not talking about hypotheticals. I like to use real threats to make the business case, but I also like to use real evidence of this is what's going on. So I'm being very surgical of what I ask, right? These patches, these systems, these rules to block this kind of access. So the business can continue. You can move into whatever the most dangerous neighborhood in Brazil is, but guess what? If we put these in place, you'll be able to do it and survive. Right. The business can grow there versus, we want to, you know, back in the day, we want to connect to the internet, but we don't want a firewall. It's like, guys, that's not good because we have routable IP addresses inside our entire network so they can get to everything. It's like, yep. Let me show you. So it's definitely using the information I get from the SIM and everything else to make the business case with reality. Right. Mm-hmm. This isn't hypotheticals. This isn't some list of to-dos I got from some government agency. This is based on experience. So I think that helps a lot, allowing me to influence the business with.
On this topic of turning on the lights and starting the conversation or giving something to have the conversation with, we kind of think of it as, you know, everybody's got a maturity model, but from the way that we've been thinking about it, looking at it, it's almost like, everybody's got to have something. You've got to turn on that foundational visibility.
Right.
Once you have that, you can start to prioritize and figure out your actions that your responders have. You can start to do automation and, kind of like get some of the manual labor off of your smart teams and sort of like the utopia is just like one single pane of glass that everybody's working from. But how would you describe that's how we see it, but how would you describe the typical trajectory of maturity in a security organization?
It's really that. It's getting visibility so you know the lay of the land. So you're all talking about the same playing field, right? Mm-hmm. Like this is what's in scope. Because without scope, you can't prioritize, right? Because then it's really prioritization based on what I last heard. I heard this on the way in on the radio. I saw this on TV. One of the friends that I know were talking about this. Because we have no visibility, we don't know that's not happening. So now it becomes a priority. It's almost like you can't tell the business no about certain things of they really want to deploy this or they really need this because you can't make the case either way of why that isn't a good idea, even though it's not based on what's going on in the organization. It's like, we only have one server that's that, and only one workstation talks to it. I don't think, we don't need to spend $1 million to try to secure that one server when we can just put Windows Firewall in and only allow that one IP. That's, you know what I mean? It's like, but being able to then answer them with a solution that meets their needs, but isn't a knee-jerk reaction to whatever's happening outside the organization. But all of that needs, all of any of that needs, no matter how much knowledge I have and technical experience, if I don't have visibility, I can't make any cases to say yes or no to anything. Then whatever comes in hottest is the priority. Or whatever we see on the news becomes a priority because I don't have the visibility to say we only have two systems that are even running that application and they both, you can't even get to them from the network, whatever. You know what I mean? They're in EMZ. But if I have the visibility, I can quickly kind of educate with reality the business on why that security control, it's ironic, the security team is saying, we don't really need that security control. We got it covered.
Yeah. As you're getting in the visibility and starting to have those conversations, what a lot of times we'll hear that the noise level starts to come up as you see all the logs and you're starting to open up and see kind of like the alerts that are coming through. But what kind of processes in place do you put in place to prioritize the noise coming in? Are you using like any kind of ML or AI to prioritize the way that you're looking and hunting for threats?
That's where having me on the team is valuable. It's 30 years of experience looking at it. And just like I said, just when I did this.
You can't scale yourself. Like you can't look at all these alerts.
Agreed. But what we do is tune very well. So we figure out what the pattern is of what's the normal behavior, get that to a filter. So then it only pops the things outside of the norm. But we haven't got to the point where we're using any of those kind of tools to replace the humans yet. But we're leveraging what we can with our sim, Splunk, to mm-hmm. help bubble up, okay, what are the recurring themes of, okay, it's this system or this user account always is running these, you know, what would be suspicious commands. Okay, that's whitelisted. We can whitelist that out because it's mm-hmm. We get very surgical, but we can only be surgical if we have, again, the right data that lets us see the pattern. Right.
Yeah.
And, that's, I guess, a skill that I have and a skill that are on some of my team members that, you know, seeing the patterns. So then we can filter the noise. But, you know, we have a.
Which does sound like, I mean, it's an ongoing fine tuning of the rule sets. And
oh, yeah. It's grindy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it takes the right team members that are willing to do the grind. Right. This isn't, you know, like firefighting. It's like, okay, some days you're going to respond to a lot of events that aren't a real fire or they're very minimal. And it'll be very grindy because then you have to roll up all the hose. You're going to do all this stuff. And, you know, every so often you'll get one of those ones that make you feel like, okay, this is why I'm here. This is my purpose. I'm going to help save a life or, you know what I mean?
Yep.
But that doesn't happen.
You don't want those firefighters doing all the boring report writing, spending half their time writing reports and those kinds of things. So you want to get everything out of their way that you can from automation and standards and stuff like that.
Yeah. See, and that is a challenge. I mean, there's a, what are they called? Where it looks like the mind map. There's mm-hmm. a mind map out there of a CISO's responsibilities. Like there's one.
I'm sure it's large.
Yeah. It's like security operations. Then it's all these other bubbles. And it was like one of those, what it feels like is, hey, cyber, you do that. And that's like, yeah, I'll take it on. And then eventually I'm like, what did I just accept? So eventually it has to get to the point where, I mean, I don't think the physical security team is off doing, you know, audits of buildings and stuff like that. They're usually former like FBI or, you know, some three-letter agency. And mm-hmm. their focus is, you know, prevent a physical breach. That's all they do. Their security guards are not off doing other things. They're watching the screen, watching the gates. They're just looking for breaches.
It's interesting. So I was at a meeting with a CISO of a large public company, and somebody asked him the question, what keeps you up at night? And he said, getting hacked and not going to jail. And, you know, so like step one, let's not get hacked or do what you can to mitigate the disruption.
That's what I meant. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
but now you have this other thing of the security and of the compliance perspective. And it seems like every week SEC or FDIC or all these agencies are coming out with new rules and laws that you kind of, that you just have to keep up with.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't think do they think that's going to help the matter and do they understand that CISOs typically work hand in hand, depending on the size of the organization, with the CIO. Yeah. And the CIO's team or IT really deploys most of the security preventive controls.
What do you think, like, from there's no lack of work to go around?
Right.
And depending on how low you go on the priority list, it's infinite work. But what do you think, from your point of view, are the talent bottlenecks in the security organization?
Funny you mentioned that. I'm trying to do something on the side that'll help educate more people. I've actually given away free mm-hmm. training, but one of the biggest issues that I think is happening in cyber, well, happened in cyber again, just through kind of, we'll call it organic growth, was the decision of, and I'm part of it, cause I've been in cyber forever, where we decided to put the most rookie individuals as the people who do the diagnosis. And I mean, you wouldn't want to do that. That doesn't even happen in a fire. In a fire, the captain who's in the front seat usually will do the 360 to determine, okay, here's our plan of attack, while mm-hmm. everybody else is getting the equipment ready. I can't imagine going to a hospital and the first year, you know, med student is doing the diagnosis of, hey, you either got cancer or you don't. It's usually the more senior people do the diagnosis and then they hand off and say, okay, go take it from here.
Right.
That's not what we do in cyber, where cyber is, hey, I've been doing this for 5 years. It's now your turn, rookie. I'm just throw it over the fence when it's something good. That's a very flawed assumption, because then you assume the rookie will know what malicious looks like, even though they've probably never seen it. They've never been part of a forensic investigation.
Yeah.
So for them, it's either, you know, after a while, it's like, this just kind of looks like the other cert util command. It's like, no. See what it did? It downloaded something from the internet. None of the other ones do that. It's like, how will they get that experience? And even if an incident goes down, it's usually then they bring in, most people bring in a third party, right? So now they don't even get that experience of, okay, what should I look for? What did you guys, were doing the forensics? What did you look for to know these 15 other machines got hit, right? It's like, now that experience comes in and goes out with a small engagement, right? And I think that somehow we got to be able to train them better and get them more repetitions on what malicious looks like before it hits. Just like, you know, I can imagine, well, I see it on TV. I almost became a doctor. That's fun. That's a different story. But where the doctor's standing there, the senior, and they have all the first year kind of residents standing around a patient and like, okay, what do you see? What do you see? What do you see? What do you see? And kind of checks for the first, 2 years they have to go through the residency of, well, you missed this, good eye on you. You saw this symptom, but you guys missed this symptom that you would have gave the wrong medicine and you might've caused some kind of heart issue. You know what I mean? That they get multiple, 2 years worth of diagnosis training, and we don't do that in cyber. So I think that's, if we want, and maybe AI and stuff like that will help, where they can go ask, hey, is this a suspicious use of cert util? And it says, yeah, it is. And it's like, okay, then I better escalate. You know what I mean? Because they don't have anybody to ask. If they keep escalating things and they're saying, oh, that was a false positive, it's like, okay, I feel pressure to escalate the right thing, right?
Yeah, it's almost like the way that the organizations are evolving end up creating more silos and drive the need for more automation, because the frontline analysts don't have the experience.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I would not want to go to a first year doctor if I thought I had something serious. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm going to go to somebody that's diagnosed this correctly for years and will pinpoint really what the issue is. So I don't have to come back 6 months later when the symptoms get so worse and they're like, oh, we should have caught it 6 months ago. Sorry. I mean, that's exactly what happens with cyber. There was probably alerts early on.
Some of the reasons why there are hacks is because people, even on help desks who are very green, they forget a process or procedure and reset a password and, oh, sure, I'll reset your MFA while I'm at it. No problem. And then next thing you know, somebody's, deep in your systems. And so it's a lot of it has to do with just experience gap. And there's such a dearth of experience in cyber, plus the demand is going way up, that, I mean, the only way is you have better training and have better automation on some of this more complex stuff.
Oh yeah. You definitely, I think they're going in the right direction, where companies are putting that kind of whatever they want to call it, basically sidekick AI, where you can nudge it. Hey, it's almost like they got a team member next to them that's not somebody else that's saying, hey, I got other jobs to do. I only do forensics. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's the biggest thing. And, the data is always everywhere and you have to do, a lot of jumping around. And if you can pull it together, you can do some more AI. We have, we're obviously working on that as well as a sidekick. Right. And there's just so much demand for asking the interface English questions. Hey, is this the problem? Where's the problem lie? Right. From operations, what's going on with this? With this transaction from security, and ask different questions here and there. And so that's like definitely something I think is going to help.
I can see it long term. It's going to be that experienced trainer that can interact with them and kind of guide them so they catch it the first time. Because again, a lot of what I've seen is there's a very, very well-known incident responder who does, I won't say his Twitter handle, but he said like 80% of the cases that he's investigated in like over a 5-year period, there was logs early on of like AV logs that said, hey, I tried to block this, but couldn't, or whatever. So it wasn't like, these attacks go unnoticed. They just go diagnosed incorrectly.
Mm.
And then once they get, like we talked, well, you kind of mentioned about getting credentials and stuff like that. Once you get credentials, whether it's the MFA codes and stuff like that or whatever, then it's much harder to find. It's almost like now the fire got in the walls. I mean, I've been in houses where the fire was burning hot in the walls and you could not tell, but it was going up to the next floor. It's like once it gets in the wall,
like UVA type stuff. Which is some complex, you know, more complex and or more advanced alerting. But there's a lot of ways to do it. There's many ways to chase the intruder around, but they can get in anywhere if they get credentialized.
Yeah, then it's a whole different story. Yeah.
Well, I know, you know, this is really interesting. I love the fire analogy. I think it applies so well, and the building codes and the risks. I think it's really interesting. And
the risk versus threat kind of thing. The risk versus threat.
Yeah. And the experienced analyst is the person that has stretched the most thin in an organization, or there's the biggest need for them. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. In a way, they become kind of a crutch where the other ones don't get it because they can get the answer so quickly from the person that becomes the shortest path, right? Because hey, they're still, you know, everybody kind of sometimes treats those incidents as tickets, so people are tracking how quickly they get closed, right? So there's this, you know, in the back of people's minds is, well, the quickest path to get this resolved is go ask the expert, right? And then the expert will say, yeah, no, this is why. And who knows if they'll remember that 15, you know, 50 alerts later, because they met their mission. They were able to properly answer the question, not diagnose, but come up with an answer to where they could close the ticket or escalate it. So
that's awesome. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's kind of goes, you know, the thing that I always am curious with is how do people do it all, right? Because we can't, we don't have the option of not doing it all. You still have to do the regulations. You still have to do the compliance reports, and you can't get hacked or you have to stay on top of it. Something will come, but you got to know that you can respond quickly so you can absorb those shocks.
Right.
And, it's good to hear some of your feedback around like moving up that maturity model, get some visibility, and start to automate what you can so you can get some time back for those really experienced folks who are out there hunting threats.
Yeah. Well, and hopefully the organization can hopefully there's a risk and compliance department, internal audit can kind of take some of that weight of the guidelines and standards off the shoulders of the firefighters. You know what I mean? It's you know, that the cities do it well. They, you know, they have a building inspection team and firefighters and police officers, and they all kind of have their priorities and their focus.
It's different personality types as well.
That's it. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the firefighters,
different skill sets.
Definitely different mentalities of they're comfortable and things just escalating really quickly and then eventually dying down and then going silent for a while and escalating. And then, you know what I mean? Where the other ones are more even keeled as far as here's the 27 compliance or inspections I have to do on these homes this week. I'll get them all done, you know, five a day, whatever. And have a slow day on Friday. So it's a different mentality because firefighters, police officers, doctors, we really can't plan our day, right? Same with incident responders. It's very almost outside driven of what activities are occurring. So
makes all the sense based on personality types in the different roles and just skill sets. And so, I really appreciate it. We're coming up on time here, but before we wrap, do you want to share some takeaways on our discussion today and what cybersecurity professionals can implement from some of your experience?
Yeah, well, it's get visibility as soon as possible. Before you really try to put in controls, validate that visibility is what you're looking for, where you might need to even bring in an outside resource that can do some red teaming or some some validation, some activity. So you can really get a sense of, do we see what we need to be seeing? So you know, getting that handle on what are the most important alerts for our environment and are they being triggered? And then working with the business on where can you put in some tighter security controls? Because to me, when I look at prevention, again, I don't think we, you know, incident or the security team can prevent an initial breach. The goal is if we put in the right controls, detective controls or preventive controls, excuse me, if we put in the right preventive controls, then the alerts spun out from preventive controls won't be such a high number that you'll overwhelm the security team. It's really about preventing the security team from missing the important alerts. So kind of knocking out kind of the commodity malware and all this commodity.
Yeah, like a risk-based alerting methodology.
Yeah. So then you can focus on the alerts that really will indicate that something has breached the organization and you need to contain it quickly. So it's really about focusing on priorities. But with visibility, then you can make business cases on where you can put in security controls to, again, help minimize the attack surface that threat actors will take advantage of.
Those great takeaways. And thanks again. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Millennium Alliance podcast. And special thanks to Craig Hyde and Todd Beebe for an engaging conversation. Be on the lookout for another episode in this partnership series sponsored by Splunk.